Welcome to Chasing American History. This is David Cross, and I am delighted to visit with you today, and we are going to be on the second episode of our discussions involving the United States Constitution. Great time to look at the Constitution. The Constitution is interesting in that everybody in America, as far as I know, says that they support the Constitution. It's the one thing everybody agrees on. Nobody disagrees. Nobody says, well, we need to start over. Nobody says, no, we need to ignore the Constitution. At least I haven't heard anybody say that. But where you get the difficulty is that, of course, everybody has a different interpretation of the Constitution. That began at the very beginning of the Constitution. And one of the reasons is that it was written in that way. It was the only way to get it passed. So we had to leave it vague. We had to leave it open to interpretation. And so we're going to discuss all of that. The biggest argument is the Second Amendment. I'm talking to you today after a recent gun attack, and once again, we have this discussion of the Second Amendment. And I'm in the bizarre situation of actually believing that each side has something to say about that argument. But I find it very interesting, the discussion people have centering around the writing of the Second Amendment. Maybe we'll have an episode on this, but the half of the people saying, well, clearly what the founders were talking about was the right to have arms in terms of having a state militia. The other half saying, no, that's not true. That's not true. And certainly, if you wanted to make it that clear, there would have been an extra word in there, a word for, and you would have been able to know for sure. But where everyone misses the point is that they were writing in such a completely different time that it's almost irrelevant what they were thinking when they wrote the Constitution on that issue. You know, people say Thomas Jefferson wanted a weak government, and therefore Thomas Jefferson never would have supported the kind of intrusions that the government makes in today's society. And that's possible. But the fact is, he's looking at a very different situation. And when he ran into a woman in France who was working two jobs and not making very much money, he was horrified. And he writes to James Madison and he says, if we ever reach that point where people are able to work but unable to make a living, then the government's going to need to step in. So it's always important to look at these people and understand the time that they're talking about, and to understand that there's things that we're going to have to figure out ourselves. They didn't know about nuclear weapons. They had no idea. It was beyond their even imagination. So to take what they're saying and to try to apply it to nuclear weapons is, I think, just using them to buttress your argument. And it's the same thing with gun violence, the way we have it today, the issue the way we have it today. This is kind of something we're going to have to figure out. And we can't go to James Madison because we live in a very different time. And there's a reason they created a constitution that can be amended. They never meant for this to be something that we would have to follow slavishly. These were guidelines of how to do things, and then as time was going to go on, there was a mechanism in there so that we could make changes to it. So to me, it's a very circular argument. We're just going to have to argue gun control versus non-gun control in terms of the effects that it has on us today, and yes, in terms of constitutional rights as they should be applied today. Anyway, I don't know why I got started on that whole thing, but it does remind me of something I want to tell you about today. We at Chasing American History are providing a couple of different long-term tours that we offer, and one of them is going to be a tour on Thomas Jefferson, which is going to be in April coming up. So if you're interested in going with us on this tour, give us a call at 610-642-2410 or check us out at chasingamericanhistory.com. This tour could almost be called a Jefferson-Madison tour because I want to include Madison in it. Just like if you go to the Franklin Roosevelt Museum, you're going to hear a lot about Eleanor. And if you go to the Kennedy Library, you should hear a lot about Bobby Kennedy. Madison and Jefferson create such an important partnership that it's important to look at both of them and to look at how they affected each other. So this is a tour that begins in Philadelphia, which was an important city to both of these individuals. Of course, Philadelphia is where Thomas Jefferson became the mega rock star that he became. This is where he writes the Declaration of Independence. That's arguably the most important moment of his life, and we're going to be able to go see the actual place where he did that. Now, the original building is not still standing, but there's been a recreation made in Philadelphia. We put it up there in 1976, but it looks just as it would have looked at the time, and you're able to go into the room where he would have been and where he actually wrote the Declaration of Independence. Of course, we're also going to be able to see what we now call Independence Hall, which was the State House. And that's where Thomas Jefferson spent time during the discussions of American independence. John Adams says he never heard him say three sentences, never heard him string three sentences together. But that's where he sat and looked out the window, at the very least. And that's where they signed his famous document, the Declaration of Independence. It's also where we have the Constitution, the creation of the Constitution. And during this tour, we're going to talk about Jefferson's involvement through Madison of the Constitution. We're going to talk about their relationship, the books that Jefferson sent to Madison, what the two said to each other during the creation of the Constitution, what they agreed on and what they disagreed on. Then, of course, if it's a Jefferson tour, we need to go to Virginia. And one of the first stops we're going to make is going to be to Natural Bridge. Natural Bridge was a place that Thomas Jefferson thought was the most beautiful place on earth. He never got to go out west. So I wish he had been able to. I took a trip to Wyoming lately. Thomas Jefferson would have just been beyond himself in delight if he had been able to do that. But he did see the Natural Bridge. He considered it one of the great wonders of the world. And he felt very strongly that it should be protected by the government, that it shouldn't be ruined. And the people out at Natural Bridge have done some recent work. I'm excited to go out and see it. It's near my old stomping grounds in Lexington, Virginia, where I went to law school. So it's going to be very exciting to see Natural Bridge, which Thomas Jefferson went to the top of and got a little dizzy, had to leave. When he writes to Maria Causeway, though, he's writing these very entrancing letters. And he tells her, you've got to come out here. You've got to visit. You've got to see Natural Bridge. I want to show you Natural Bridge. I want to show you Monticello. Eventually, she says, okay, I'm coming. And he says, what are you talking about? You can't come out here. Jefferson, there's always the question of reality versus fantasy. What's pleasurable to write and what's able to actually be achieved? And discussions can be had about that, not only with Maria, but of course with the Declaration of Independence. You know, Abraham Lincoln is going to say, this is the document that requires us to fight the Civil War. And one of the things I love about the Declaration is that it's not jingoistic. He isn't just writing to Americans. He doesn't say all Americans are created equal. It's to mankind, and that's what Jefferson's about. He's not about the country as much as he's about the role the country is going to have as this Eden that's going to transform the entire world. We're not going to need an army. People are going to want to be like us because we're going to have freedom of speech. We're going to have freedom of religion. We're going to be able to worship as we please. And I sometimes read biographies where people get very upset with Thomas Jefferson for fighting with John Adams, for fighting with George Washington, and they say, well, he's not a very good friend. And I always feel like these people are dealing with these issues as if, you know, it's two girls fighting over a boy in junior high school. This was important to Jefferson. This is the future of mankind. And when he saw it being subverted in his mind, then he was going to take measures to stop that from happening. So we're going to discuss that. We're also going to visit Williamsburg, Virginia, which was an important place to Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson used to love visiting the governor out there, and he said these were the most remarkable nights of his life where people would sit up and drink wine and discuss philosophy. We're also going to visit the actual tavern where Thomas Jefferson was shot down by a woman that he felt that he loved very much. We're going to see, of course, Monticello. I mean, Monticello is one of the most spectacular places you can visit, and it's Jefferson. You know, nobody normal builds a house on top of a mountain. If you or I had that idea, we would be talked out of it in about 5 minutes. Because somebody would say, that's ludicrous. That's going to take at least 10, 15 years just to level the mountain. Then you're going to need to get the bricks up the mountain. Then you're going to need to get water up the mountain. Jefferson wanted his house on top of a mountain. And it didn't matter that he had no money. It didn't matter that he was in debt. He's going to have his house exactly the way he wants his house to be. And so going to Monticello is a thrilling and sobering experience. Sobering because of the involvement of slavery, because of the fact that Jefferson gets himself deeper and deeper into slavery the older he gets until it's impossible for him to extricate himself from it. We're going to see the dumb waiter he created in large part because he was so ashamed of slavery that he didn't want slaves walking in with food, so it would be like Star Trek, right? The food would just appear. We're going to see where Sally Hemings lived. Recently, Monticello has discovered this place. So we're going to discuss Sally Hemings. We're going to discuss slavery. There's no getting around that. Thomas Jefferson is one of the most pleasurable subjects, and he's also one of the most depressing of subjects, because there's things that, if you're me anyway, there's things I just admire so much about him, there's things that I love so much about him, and then there's just terrible, terrible fact of slavery, which there's no getting around. For years, people just kind of tried to avoid it. You know, I love the Dumas Malone books, but that was a time when you could just kind of say, well, it wasn't time for that. And really, John Meacham says the same thing. Well, he was a pragmatist. What he was also, and this has to be said, is a man who was more interested in keeping his toys than in freeing human beings. I mean, that's just a fact. And that's part of the whole picture of Thomas Jefferson. There's wonderful things and there's terrible things, much like our country. And we're going to discuss them, but we're going to do it, I hope, in a way that is going to increase your interest, increase your knowledge, and is certainly going to be pleasurable. We're going to have a drink at City Tavern, which was Thomas Jefferson's favorite spot in Philadelphia. And then, as I say, we're going to also have a drink and meals at the tavern in Williamsburg, where he spent many, many hours. We're also going to see his second house that he used to live in. You know, in those days, if you're an ex-president, people felt like they had the right to show up at your house. And that meant you had to put them up, you had to give them wine, you had to give them entertainment. And for somebody like Thomas Jefferson, the worst thing about that is you're stealing his time, which is very important to him. So Jefferson used to come down to the dinner table with a book. And if you weren't interesting, he was going to read his book, probably. Now, people always say he was a very elegant hostess and so forth, but I think if he felt that he had the right to use his time in the way he most loved, which was reading. And if too many people came, he just left and he went to this second house that we're going to visit as well. On the way back, we're going to see the Jefferson Memorial, one of the most beautiful memorials in the country to any founding father. And so anyway, if you would be interested in that, give us a call or check us out at chasingamericanhistory.com. Look us up at phillybowtietours@gmail.com and let us know that you would like to come, because it's going to be a lot of fun. Now let's get to our subject of today, the Constitution. We talked last week about James Otis and the writs of assistance, which were basically warrants that allowed the search of homes without probable cause, without any explanation on it. And James Otis fought against those writs, argued against those writs, lost the argument. And when I say he lost the argument, I say the court ruled against him. But England never tried to enforce those writs again, so in a larger sense, he won the argument. Now we're going to move on to Sam Adams and discuss Sam Adams a little bit. You know, we all know the Sam Adams beer. We've all heard of Sam Adams. Sam Adams, as far as I can tell, is the first person to really start thinking about American independence as a possibility, not someday in the future, but pretty much immediately. There were others who looked at maps and said, you know, we're going to be a nation one day. And probably John Adams, his cousin, was one of those. He would look at a map and he would say, well, this isn't going to continue. There's going to come the point when we are not going to be controlled by this little island that's so far away. There's going to be the point where we have enough people that we're not going to have to put up with that. But it's Sam Adams who's going to push things. It's Sam Adams who's going to purposely annoy the British in the hopes that they're going to overreact. It's Sam Adams who's going to do as much as anybody else in these early days to bring about American independence. Now, Sam's father was more than just a preacher. Sam Adams's father, Deacon Adams, he was a well-respected justice of the peace. He was a selectman. He was part of the colonial legislature. He was part of trade clubs. He was part of political clubs. People came to him and discussed politics. People came to him to discuss current issues. People came to him for advice. And he was always there for what I'll call the common man. I mean, I don't know what that means. It's kind of an obnoxious phrase, but he's there for the folk who need advice, not the rich and the wealthy who are coming in, but the everyday people who are working for their living and trying to find out how to survive from day to day. Deacon Adams was almost always in opposition to crown privileges wherever there was an issue. He believed that the people in Massachusetts had certain God-given rights. The Enlightenment. The Enlightenment is the big character of this revolution that is going to be controlling the ideas of these people. I mean, there's a reason that all of a sudden all of these people are starting to say, well, wait a minute, why do we have to do this? Why are we following what the king says? And you know, the Enlightenment is this period where people are looking at things from new angles, people are rediscovering things, people are examining issues that used to go unexamined. And one of the things that's really a staple of the Enlightenment is that people are born with rights and that these rights come from your creator. You know, I saw something I was pretty amazed about the other day. This Republican candidate, Roy Moore, he won the Republican nomination for Senate, and a lot of people say that he's a crazy guy, he's out there, he's a wacko. He may be, I know nothing about him. But I hear this commercial or this statement being made by a senator about him, saying that he's completely out of tune with the country, that he's a complete radical. And then they played a clip of him saying that you don't get your rights from Congress, you get your rights from God. And I thought, well, that's, I mean, have we gotten to the point where the Declaration of Independence is ludicrously radical because it says we don't get our rights from the government? Have we really reached the point where people think that you get your rights from the government and that anybody who doesn't agree with that is a radical? I found that to be an amazing moment. This was played by another senator saying, see, look at this guy. How crazy can you be? He says, you know, you get your rights from God. Okay, well, once upon a time, the Declaration of Independence, one of the things that was important about it was that it was this document that helped explain what it means to be American. And that was one of the ideas. You're born with rights. You're born with natural rights. Nobody can take it away from you. And if your government violates those rights, you have a right to overthrow that government. Now, that's basic being an American 101 in my book. That's what it means. And if we're going to reach the point where that's a radical concept that the majority of us can't go along with, then we've really gone a long way and a sad way in our history. Anyway, back then, people were saying that, no, we don't get our rights from the king. We get our rights naturally. Everybody's born with natural rights. This was something Sam Adams certainly believed, and this was something his father, Deacon Adams, believed. Now, Deacon Adams had attempted to form a bank in which members could put up the value of their land in exchange for banknotes. Now, that's a very scary thing to England, because if the Americans start creating their own banks and creating their own money, that's going to cut off the British. That's going to hurt the British quite a bit. So British, even colonial merchants, they're going to oppose paper money because they profit by advancing credit to customers that are in need of goods. And having paper notes is going to allow them to bypass these normal routes of credit. And basically what a paper note is like credit, but it's getting credit from a different source. And it's cutting out the British middleman. They're not going to allow this. England is not going to allow this any more than when the United States becomes a country, they're going to allow it. Because as we're going to hear in many episodes, one of the primary reasons that the Constitution was created is because that there were so many very democratic constitutions in the states that were allowing for this same kind of paper money that was very harmful to the elite, and something had to be done to stop that. But that is a later story for a later day. Back then, we're dealing with the colonies versus Great Britain, and Deacon Adams wants to empower the local people to be able to exchange money without having to go to England to do so. Now, in order to destroy Deacon Adams and his bank, the royal governor, whose name was Jonathan Belcher, he saw to the formation of a rival bank that issued notes based on silver deposits. And that was something only the very wealthy possessed. No member of the land bank could also subscribe to the silver bank. And Belcher saw to it that the silver bank was going to become necessary for a number of transactions. Then he saw to it that anybody who had any involvement with Deacon Adams's bank was not going to be selected to his council. He wasn't going to be able to be in the legislature. He wasn't going to be able to be a justice of peace. They were going to squeeze out anybody who was going to frequent the Adams bank. Deacon Adams, of course, was removed from his political posts. And the Crown Party appealed to Parliament, which of course agreed, and issued an act that not only dissolved Deacon Adams's bank, but it held Deacon Adams personally responsible for the loss of money that people incurred. This destroyed Deacon Adams financially. So here we have the same story that we just discussed last week. The personal being combined with the political. Sam Adams saw Great Britain destroy his father, destroy the people that tried to help his father, because they sought independence of the British financial cleaver. You oppose the British, they will crush you. That's what Sam Adams learned. They will crush you unless you can win. Now, the governor had done more, though, than just destroy Deacon Adams. He fueled a deep resentment towards Parliament in the rural districts of Massachusetts. It wasn't just Sam Adams and Deacon Adams who were angry. There were a lot of people who saw this. John Adams would later say, "The act to destroy the land bank scheme raised greater ferment in the province than the Stamp Act did." It enraged people. People saw what Great Britain had done to Deacon Adams. People saw what Great Britain had done to those people who merely wanted to create their own bank. Now, Sam went to graduate school at Harvard, but he watched as his own potential inheritance whittled away to almost nothing. Now, the conflict would not go away, he saw. There's going to be a showdown between England and the colonies. And he sees this, maybe before anybody else does. In an attempt to set limits to the royal government's intervention in colonial affairs, limits that might protect his family, Sam Adams pored over the works of the Enlightenment, the writings of John Locke, who argued that all men were born with the right to life, liberty, and property. The role of government was simply to protect these rights, not to limit them. There's no such thing as a divine right of kings which bounds subjects, no matter what it was that the king did. If a king violated his duties to the people, that king should be replaced. And Sam, no doubt, thought about his own family and what the Parliament had done to them when he read Locke's words. "It is a mistake," Locke said. "It is a mistake to think this fault is proper only to monarchies. Other forms of government are liable to it as well as that. For wherever the power that is put in any hands for the government of the people and the preservation of their properties is applied to other ends and made use of to impoverish, harass." Now, Sam Adams is going to give the commencement speech after his master's degree in 1743. He's 21 years old at the time, and his thesis is going to be, "Whether it be lawful to resist the supreme magistrate if the Commonwealth cannot be otherwise preserved." At a time when virtually nobody is thinking about the breakup of the colonies in England, Sam Adams is. Now, having graduated, Sam found that he no longer felt any calling to the ministry. He had for some time wanted to be a deacon, just like his father was. But now his interests revolve around political thought, and his father advised him to study law, which might be helpful in his political career. But his mother said, "No, you don't want to do that." Adams's biographer, Mark Pulse, writes that the family was entangled in acrimonious battles to protect their property, and she likely did not want her son to make those kinds of battles a way of life. Smart lady. His father urged him to learn how to make a living with some kind of venture or other. Learn something, is what he said. But Sam's one of these guys who's not really good at anything except the big thing that he ends up spending his life on. Now, his father's going to loan money to Sam so that he can get started on his own, and Sam ends up lending this money to friends who need it. He loses all the money. Eventually, Deacon Adams is going to bring Sam into his malt house. Again, he's not going to be really impressed with Sam Adams's work ethics when it comes to the malt house. He wasn't interested in the malt house. He was interested in politics. It was the only thing that really excited him. And he continued to speak out against what he believed to be British encroachment of colonial rights. Now, he and his friends formed a club to stage debates and launched a publication which was open to whatever may be adapted to state and defend the rights and liberties of mankind. After his father died, Sam Adams inherited property, which was valueless. It was overburdened by debt, and the authorities threatened to seize this property. Now, if I was told, or probably if you were told by the government, that they were going to seize your property, we'd probably have a lawyer look into it, and we might seek to settle the problem with some kind of an agreement. But very few of us would openly defy it. You know, in this day and age, that's only what crazy radicals do, right? People in Waco, Texas, standing up against the government is considered to be almost insane in this day and age. But this was a different time, and Sam Adams was a different kind of person. And Sam Adams was not going to turn his house over just because the Parliament told him to do so. He believed the Parliament had no constitutional authority to dissolve the land bank, and that it had no power to take his land, since there was a breach of the rights under the Massachusetts Charter in destroying the bank. He wrote a letter to the sheriff that was going to carry out the sale of his home, and the letter was vaguely threatening. They put off the sale several times, and finally the sheriff went through with it. But Adams showed up, and there was no potential bidder. Everybody sort of knew either people were in solidarity with Sam Adams or else they didn't want to make him his enemy. Nobody purchased the land. So Sam is going to learn an important lesson as he retains his property. Later we're going to hear about how George Washington learned that the British Army can lose. He knew that because he fought with the British Army when they lost. He saw why they lost a battle during the French Indian War. Now here, Sam Adams learns that the British Parliament could lose if you stood up to them. You know, it's like that year in the NFL when New England won every single game of the year. And then the last game of the season, they won against the New York Giants, who were had barely a season over 500, but who made it into the playoffs. Well, the Giants ended up facing New England, and they beat them because they had just seen them. They weren't scared of them anymore. That mystique of the New England Patriots had disappeared. Well, George Washington is going to lose that mystique of the British Army. And Sam Adams loses that mystique. He sees that these people can be defeated if you just stand up to them. Adams wrote in regards to the Massachusetts Charter, "Our invaluable charter secures to us all the English liberties, beside which we have some additional privileges which the common people there have not." So in other words, while England says we don't have a right to representation, for instance, they'll represent us, Sam Adams goes the other way. Not only do we have every rights of an Englishman, we have more, because we had the guts to cross the river. We had the guts to start our own places out in the New World. We have more guts than you. We're tougher than you. We're better than you. He says, "We, their posterity, are this day reaping the fruits of their toils, happy beyond expression, in the form of our government, in the liberty we enjoy, if we know our own happiness and how to improve it." In other words, this expanded freedom was the reward they get from their ancestors who had the courage to make the trip to America. Now, nothing better explains the colonial mindset and how much it differed from the British one than this article of Sam Adams's. While the British believed that America was a mere satellite of their empire, kind of a minor league team to their major league team, the Americans saw that they were in a more exalted place, which thrived on and which required human ingenuity. More importantly, the colonists believed, assumed really as a matter beyond argument, that both the British Constitution and the charters operated as laws directly to the colonies. I mean, why wouldn't they? Why would they have less rights as British subjects than somebody who was born in England? That didn't make any sense to anybody in America. What they didn't realize was that in England, the idea that the Americans believed that the English Constitution applied to them was equally unthought of, equally absurd. So what you have is these two different powers who are not so much arguing, but who are looking at things in such a different way that they don't even think that the issue that's going to ultimately break them apart exists. It's kind of like if a man and a woman get married, and 3 years into the marriage, the man says, "Well, you know, we need to start having children because we're going to have three children, so we need to get started." And the woman says, "We're not having any children." And then they realize they've been operating under different ideas of their relationship all this time, and they never really sat down and discussed it. Now, the other interesting thing we get from reading this article of Sam Adams's is about the great hope and sense of opportunity that these Americans felt about the future and the colonies. You know, they no longer feel like the British are any better than they are. And they think that they're better. And they're feeling strong. And they're feeling hopeful and optimistic in the American colonies. And they're really not going to put up with a foreign country bullying them. Now, on April 5th, 1764, England is going to pass what was known as the Sugar Act. Now, the Sugar Act revived unenforced duties on wool and hats and iron, and increased customs on a variety of imported goods, like textiles, coffee, indigo, wines, sugar. Now, Boston was the first American town to discover this when a cargo ship arrived from London. And the news caused nothing. No reaction. The costs were buried away in the price of the products, and no one seemed the least bit bothered by this. Except for one person, Sam Adams. Let me be clear, it was Sam Adams alone and by himself who saw that this could be the beginning of something far more egregious. And Sam Adams alone and by himself believed that something had to be done about this right now. As he began writing and speaking, he was met, though, with a profound disinterest. Nobody cared. It was the belief of everyone, all of his neighbors, that there was really nothing you could do about this. And as I say, the costs were buried into the price of the product. Well, Adams is undeterred. In the spring months of 1764, he begins to plot a strategy by orchestrating a boycott of English goods. Now, this was a pretty novel approach. Adams knew that it would be fruitless unless he was able to bring the other 12 colonies along with him, though. He needed to unite the 13 colonies, and no one had tried to do this since Benjamin Franklin made an unsuccessful attempt in his Albany Plan back in 1754 to bring the colonies together. That's where you may have seen that famous flag or sign of Benjamin Franklin's with a snake cut into 13 parts. And that was Franklin's argument back in 1754 that we can't survive on our own. We have to survive together. That wasn't even a thought in most people's mind. You have to understand, most people never went 20 miles away from their home during their entire lives. So the idea that South Carolina had anything in common with New Hampshire was unthought of. I mean, the only thing that connected these colonies was they all had an arrangement and a relationship with England. That was it. There's nothing else that connected them. And Sam Adams, this visionary, realizes we have to bring the other colonies into this thing. We can't do this on our own. We'll never win this thing on our own. Only way we're going to be able to defeat the British, and I believe that's what's in his mind already, defeating the British. Only way we're going to do that is to get all of these colonies together. So what can Adams do? Well, he didn't hold an elected post. He didn't have any massive press apparatus, as Franklin might have had. What he did do was to address a town meeting. He argued that the taxes had to be resisted. He spoke, writes his biographer, like a fire and brimstone evangelist in a deadly serious tone that stirred listeners. He stated that the freedom of the colonies depended on the power to self-govern and to self-tax. Without those twin powers, their liberty was gone. And he asked people if they wanted their lands taxed by the British, if they wanted the British to take money away from them from their own labor. He argued the economics of the tax. Taxes slowed growth, he said. Americans spent millions on British goods, and this outweighed any tax in terms of providing revenue for the British government. What he was arguing was that duties and taxes would actually reduce and not increase government revenues. Now, this is 13 years before Britain's Adam Smith is going to write The Wealth of Nations, which makes much the same argument. Sam Adams, unschooled in such matters, unable to make a living, by the way, on his own, he's going to be among the first ever to argue this point of view. He wrote, "It is the trade of the colonies that renders them beneficial to the mother country. Our trade, as it is now, and always has been conducted, centers in Great Britain, and in return for her manufactures, affords her more ready cash, beyond any comparison, than can possibly be expected by the most sanguine promoters of these extraordinary methods." In other words, listen, you're getting our goods. You're getting our goods at rock-bottom prices. By the way, you're also ripping us off when you sell things to us. You're making enough from us. Do not tax us. That is where we are going to draw the line. Now, Sam Adams is going to propose a Congress. He's going to say that we need to have a united front against these British and have a Congress that by united application of all who are aggrieved, all may happily obtain redress. This is the first time anybody says anything like this. It is the first time that anybody's going to think of having a Congress to question Parliament's right to tax the colonies or its authority in America. He's the first person to threaten an intercolonial boycott. He's going to write the first criticism of non-American juries to try Americans. He puts it all into this article. Now, at a town meeting on May 24th, 1764, Adams urged residents to approve all of these instructions, and this was done. As soon as this was done, the royal governor of Massachusetts shut down the assembly to prevent the measure from proceeding. He suspended any future sessions until October. But what he could not suspend was the first utterance of these revolutionary ideas. They spread. They spread like wildfire. They spread like a disease through the colonies. Patrick Henry in Virginia read them and was inspired to run for office. Others were similarly affected. Now, Adams sees that he's in this struggle for the long haul. He had created some new strategies for civil disobedience, and his maxim was this: put and keep the enemy in the wrong. This is what he's going to do throughout his whole career. This is his great genius. He's going to do just enough to enrage England enough to do too much. And that's going to make England look bad all around the world. And, of course, it's going to enrage people in the colonies. You know, Governor Hutchinson later of Massachusetts, he's going to tell the king, you don't have to worry about the colonies. They can't do anything together. They're like a pile of sticks. If you let them go, they fall into different ways. Sam Adams knows that too. There's only one thing that's going to keep these colonies together, and that's an external threat, the threat of Great Britain. So that's why it's so important to Sam Adams to get England to put itself in the wrong. That's going to be his overarching theory throughout everything he does, all of his campaigns, all of his writings, all of his speeches. When England announced that it was implementing its Stamp Act, Sam Adams was ready and able to combat it. And now the people were more ready to listen. They'd listened to what he said before. People had read his article. People had heard about what he'd proposed back in Massachusetts. Now, the Stamp Act was a clumsy attempt by England to tax the colonies. And it was the worst kind of tax they could create because, as you may know, the Stamp Act is going to tax all written material. So Sam Adams must have been delighted. That's great. You're going to tax lawyers. You're going to tax newspapers. You're taxing the people who are going to make the biggest stink about it. And Sam Adams is going to start working 24/7 to coalesce an opposition to this Stamp Act. Now, to many people, there's just nothing you can do about these things. You know, Benjamin Franklin, he's off living in England. He's a little bit out of touch. And when he hears about the Stamp Act, he says, "We might as well have hindered the sun's setting as to try to hinder it." In other words, there's nothing we can do. And he goes off and he gets friends, jobs as stamp collectors, because even though he's not a big fan of the Stamp Act, what can we do about it? Well, as I say, he's off in England. Sam Adams is back in America, in Massachusetts, and Sam Adams knows from his earlier speeches regarding the Sugar Act that people are reaching the point where they are ready to oppose these kinds of measures. He saw that they were riled. He saw that citizens from the other colonies were becoming angry too. And this time around, he didn't have to do a lot to get people upset. They got upset pretty quickly. As soon as this thing was announced, ministers railed against it from pulpits, citizens complained about it in town meetings, legislators drafted resolutions denouncing it, stamp agents were threatened with physical harm. Adams's work on the Sugar Act wasn't successful, but it was successful in preparing people for the next battle. Adams put all of his energies into destroying the Stamp Act. He called together a meeting of local merchants and tradesmen and described the way that Britain would be able to control the American colony if they were able to directly tax the American colonies without their consent. Adams told them that England did not view the colonies as trade partners. They were rivals. He's saying, you need to wake up. We're a rival economic interest. They're never going to give us the freedom to do what we need to do. Why should they? As long as they have unfair tactics that they're able to use, they're going to keep us down, just like they kept my father down. Adams argued that this tax amounted to servitude. A man's property is the fruit of his industry, And if it may be taken from him under any pretense whatever, at the will of another, he cannot be said to be free, for he labors like a bond slave, not for himself, but for another. As to England's argument that the American colonies owed money to England for their help in the French Indian War, Adams says they don't owe them a penny. They received no meaningful help, and that the war was fought for the benefit of England, not for the benefit of America. Did England alone run deeply in debt in conquering the French in America? Did not the colonies bear a great share in the expense of it? He asked. Now, Adams's advice is simple. Purchase no British goods. Sell nothing to the British. Resist any attempts by crown officials to implement this nefarious tax. Adams also proposed that a Congress of all the colonies meet to discuss what to do in response to England's plan. Again, he's pushing for this idea of a Congress. The governor shut down the assembly in Massachusetts, but not before they proposed the Stamp Act Congress that would meet in New York. Governor Barnard assured London that nothing would be done in consequence of this intended Congress. And Governor Hutchinson, as I already mentioned, no two colonies think alike. There is no uniformity of measures. The bundle of sticks thus separated will be easily broken. Meanwhile, Adams well understood that victory would not come only from high-handed arguments of natural rights. Soon, people were marching in the streets, carrying pictures of tax collectors hanging from trees. Early demonstrations brought about resignations from the tax collectors, and they were celebrated throughout the colonies. The people shouted, and their shout was heard to the distant end of the continent, Adams said. However, when the angry mob destroyed the house and the belongings of Lieutenant Governor Hutchinson, Adams condemned the action, took care to have tighter control of ongoing events. From this point on, Sam Adams was going to do everything he could to make sure that what these people wanted, what he and his friends were pushing for, was not taken over by any unruly mobs. Now, the Stamp Act Congress included 9 states, and James Otis attended on behalf of Massachusetts. And he impressed everybody with his verbal brilliance and his knowledge. A fellow delegate said that not one appeared to be so complete a master of every subject or threw so much light on every question as James Otis. Now, the Congress is going to write a series of resolutions, and it sent over the first signed petition to the King of England and Parliament, arguing that taxation without representation violated basic civil rights of all British subjects, and they maintained that only colonial legislatures could tax Americans. So please hear this. They're not saying we're not British subjects. They're just saying we deserve the same rights as all other British subjects, and under the great British unwritten constitution, we have these rights. And we're just asking you to implement these rights as you would for anybody else in the empire. Sam Adams would say that Americans are unarguably entitled to those essential rights in common with all men. No law of society can, consistent with the law of God and nature, divest them of those rights. Now, we're going to hear that language when Thomas Jefferson sets his pen to paper to write the Declaration of Independence. Adams's document was incendiary. All acts made by any power whatever, other than the General Assembly of this province, imposing taxes on the inhabitants, are infringements of our inherent and unalienable rights as men and British subjects, and render void the most valuable declarations of our charter. Now, Massachusetts, under the guidance of Sam Adams, had just made this tremendous leap. This was no longer simply a matter of a tax. This goes to the core of the relationship between Great Britain and the colonies. What Sam Adams is saying is that by coming to America, by effectuating the Massachusetts Charter, these men were in charge of their own government. England was too far away to do this. And frankly, England had no understanding of American values or of American issues. To be governed by a far-off island was to lose inherent rights of self-governance. London, looking at these resolves, was not impressed, deeming them ravings of apostle of wild enthusiasts. Now, on the day that the Stamp Act was to take effect, Sam Adams had arranged for appropriate responses. Sam Adams is a great showman. He's always going to prove himself to be. Bostonians treated the day as a wake. Bells tolled, guns were fired in the air, flags flew at half-mast. Stamps were seized and burned. Figures were burned in effigy around the Liberty Tree. Adams operated on numerous fronts. He chaired a committee to come up with ways to allow businesses to continue without stamps. He led another to protest the cost of maintaining troops to guard the stamps. He led another committee to form a legal team to appeal to Governor Bernard and to open the judicial courts. For this, he's going to bring in a new face to the cause, his cousin, John Adams, a young man desirous of making his mark on the history books. But he's hesitant at this time. He sees his cousin leaping into the fray, and he's a little slower, he's a little more hesitant, but as he studies the issues, he's going to come to feel as strongly as Sam Adams does about them. Now, at the end of the day, it's the boycott that did the trick. Money, power. These are things that count, not philosophical arguments over natural rights. The British looked toward America as its prime source of exportation. I mean, the idea of a national boycott terrified them. Adam Smith would write this: "The expectation of a rupture with the colonies has struck the people of Great Britain with more terror than they ever felt for a Spanish Armada or a French invasion. It was this terror, whether well or ill-founded, which rendered the repeal of the Stamp Act, among the merchants at least, a popular measure." Yes, the Stamp Act is repealed. Sam Adams is victorious. England bows to the popular stance, and the people in America celebrate. They celebrate the king for seeing the truth. They celebrate Parliament. What they don't really get yet, although I'm sure Sam Adams knows that, is that Great Britain has not bought into any of the arguments the Americans made. They realized, A, they didn't want to withstand a boycott. B, how are you going to effectuate a tax when all the tax collectors resign and those who don't resign are going to be probably tarred and feathered? I mean, there was no way to win on this one. So they're going to do the intelligent thing. They're going to withdraw on this battlefield, and then they're going to try to create a new battlefield where they will be better able to secure victory. What they're not going to do is to accept these ravings of these colonial radicals that they're not controlled by the Parliament. That they will not be willing to accept. What are they going to do? Well, you're going to have to join us next week, aren't you? Find out what England does in response to their having to bow down on the Stamp Act, and find out what Sam Adams and the Americans do in response to the British. You're not going to want to miss this. It's some pretty amazing stuff. Join us next week for the third episode of The Constitution.